Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you very much. Delight to speak to you again. I thought that since the majority of my talk last night focused on food, I would speak a little about drink. And whereas last night was in some respects more theoretical, this will be more practical. So I'm going to, as you know, I've written a couple of cocktail books, and the goal of those cocktail books was to answer the question, what to drink? What to drink for certain feast days in order to honor a certain saint. That was the goal, but I got a surprise bonus. I also discovered that the more I researched into these things, I not only learned lessons in what to drink, but in how to drink. That there are certain rules that the saints observed in order to enjoy life and yet be virtuous. And it is some of those talking points or rules that I would like to share with you today. So the title of my talk is How to Drink Like a Saint. And it is in 5 easy lessons. So lesson number 1, how to drink like a saint. Drink with moderation. Now, the fact that none of you booed is a very good sign. We're off to a good start. Drinking in moderation is obviously the most moral thing to do, the most ethically responsible thing to do. I teach at Baylor University, which is the world's oldest and largest Baptist university. And every now and then, you get a student, a non-Catholic student, who doesn't understand that there's a difference between drunkenness and drinking in moderation. So when the subject of alcohol comes up, they'll, you know, quote St. Paul condemning drunkenness. And indeed, St. Paul does condemn drunkenness, but the same St. Paul who condemns drunkenness is the same St. Paul who orders his disciple Timothy to drink wine when he has a stomach ailment. The Bible is very consistent. It consistently condemns drunkenness, but it just as consistently treats the consumption of wine as a normal part of a healthy culture, which is why wine is at the highest day of the Jewish year, the Passover, and it is why it was at the Last Supper and transformed into a sacrament. And it was our Lord's first public miracle at the wedding of Cana. The distinction is crucial. Drinking in moderation is a virtuous activity. Drinking to excess is not. So it's obviously the most moral thing to do. What is interesting is if I can't appeal, and I know I can with you, but if I couldn't appeal to your sense of honor, to your moral code, the next thing I would do is appeal to your self-interest. Drinking with moderation is not only the most moral thing to do, it actually is the most pleasurable. It is the most pleasant. There was a school in antiquity called the Epicureans. You may have heard of them. We now use this as a term for, you know, a bon vivant, someone who loves the finer things of life. The Epicureans did not believe in the immortality of the soul. They did not believe in an afterlife. And they believed that physical pleasure was the highest good. Now, you put all those things together, you might think that the Epicureans were hedonists, that they'd be out just treating every day like Mardi Gras. But the funny thing about the Epicureans is that in antiquity, they were renowned for their moderation because they understood the way to maximize physical pleasure is to take these goods in moderation. It is when you eat or drink to excess that you start to get a diminishing return on your investments. So even if I can't appeal to high moral ground, I can appeal to your naked self-interest that moderation is the most pleasant thing to do. When it comes to drinking, I also think that drinking in moderation is the most conducive to good conversation. And one of the reasons to drink together is for the sake of good conversation, good fellowship. Drinking in moderation loosens the tongue just enough to maybe drop one or two social inhibitions, but not enough to divorce your tongue from all rational thought. There was a study done among college students several years ago. This study was not done at Baylor, which is a dry campus. It involved three groups of students who were about to take an exam. Group A had no beers. Group B had one beer. And group C had two beers. Guess which group did the best? That's right. The group that had one beer did the best on the exam. By the way, I'm not giving you any advice on how to take a... right? Just for the record. You got your 10 a.m. organic chemistry. I'm not saying that. Right? But it's interesting that the group that did the best is the group that had one beer, followed by the group that had no beers, and in dead last, the two beers. But that's kind of my point with alcohol and conversation, right? You don't want to drink to where you're not thinking clearly. The point is to sort of loosen things up just enough. Have you ever heard that St. Thomas Aquinas is often credited with the phrase that you can drink usque ad hilaritatem, that you can drink up to the point of cheerfulness, and then after that point, it becomes a vice, right? Aquinas never said that, but it was a Neo-Thomist, an author of the Manual tradition, Father Dominic Prumer, who did coin that phrase. He said it's okay to drink usque ad hilaritatem, but then he gives an exception where you could maybe even do just a little bit more for the sake of charity. You're at a really dull wedding and nobody's talking. And the only way to get the ball rolling is for you to have a stiffy. And those are my words. I'm paraphrasing Father Dominic Prumer right now. But he basically, it just so cracks me up because he's like kind of a stern German moral theologian. So it just cracks me up that he gives this example, like you're at a really boring wedding and for the sake of the bride and groom, you really need to get the ball rolling. Have that extra shot and start talking. So I leave you to figure out all of the implications of that. But anyway, my point is that moderate drinking and good conversation are meant to go hand in hand. And then finally, moderate drinking is essential to health. Excessive drinking is susceptible to all kinds of medical and family and social problems, as I'm sure, you know, all of us in the room are aware. But it is this association with alcohol and good health that I believe is one of the reasons why the Catholic Church has had such a long history, not only tolerating alcohol, but in some respects, promoting its development. One of the things that surprised me in researching Drinking with the Saints is how instrumental the Catholic Church has been in the development of certain kinds of alcohol. Whiskey is believed to have been invented by Irish monks who shared their knowledge of distillation with the Scottish when they evangelized them. And I mentioned this to someone at the table the other night. The first written instance of whiskey is in an Irish medical manual where it is prescribed as a cure for, quote, paralysis of the tongue. And it definitely works for the Irish. Sláinte, the world's most magical liqueur is chartreuse. It has been made for over 500 years in only one place, the Charterhouse of the Carthusians in the French Alps. The secret is so tightly guarded that only two monks know it. It is never written down. The development of beer, our modern brewing techniques, is from medieval monks. It may have been the ancient Babylonians who invented beer. But beer as we know it today is the product of medieval monastic Christendom. And when you think of the wine industries around the world, like I'm from California, so I think of the California wine industry and St. Junipero Serra. Why did Franciscans introduce viniculture to California so they could celebrate the central cultic act of their lives, the Eucharist. Jesuit, Franciscan, Dominican missionaries brought with them wherever they went into the New World, not just the Gospels, but a knowledge of how to make, how to raise wheat and make bread and viniculture. Because you couldn't always depend on supply lines from Spain or wherever, right? And so it was the fact that we are a Eucharistic people that we spread the knowledge of making wine around the world. And now some of the best wines are made in these places. California, Chile, Argentina, Australia, you know, all of this had to do with the celebration of the Mass. And all of this, again, having to do with health, right? Taken in moderation, these things are good for you. Okay, so that's the first talking point, how to drink like a saint, drink with moderation. Don't worry, the other ones are a lot shorter than that and less didactic. The second way to drink like a saint is to drink with gratitude. Chesterton has a great line, we should thank God for beer and burgundy by not drinking too much of them. Gratitude is a much ignored virtue these days. We live in an age that is increasingly focused on entitlement, right? What is owed to me? Often we have a grievance. Maybe we feel victimized by something, societal or personal, and we feel entitled to something in return. I'm not saying there are not victims in this world, and I'm not saying you're not entitled to anything. I think what I am saying, though, is a person who is characterized by a sense of entitlement is an unhappy person. Have you ever met a person who feels entitled very passionately about X, Y, and Z, and is just perfectly happy? Conversely, have you ever met a truly grateful human being who is miserable? Do you remember VeggieTales, Madame Blueberry? A grateful heart is a happy heart, right? It's true. VeggieTales was true. a truly thankful heart is happy. A heart filled with gratitude is a happy heart. There is no happy human being on earth who is ungrateful, right? Think about that. So gratitude is absolutely crucial. So drink with a sense of gratitude. And think of how this ties into the Eucharist, right? Which means thanksgiving. To be a Eucharistic people is to be a grateful people. So the second way to drink like a saint is to drink with gratitude. The third way to drink like a saint is to drink with memory. And notice how that is tied into gratitude. How can I be grateful if I don't remember the things that I have been undeservedly given? Right? Memory and gratitude go hand in glove. And again, think of the Eucharistic tie-in. This act of thanksgiving due in memory of me. You can't be thankful to Jesus Christ until you remember what he did for you. Right? I dare submit to you that this criterion of drinking with memory is one of the key ways of distinguishing healthy drinking from unhealthy drinking. Healthy drinking is drinking to remember, and unhealthy drinking is drinking to forget. Have you ever been to a really good Catholic wedding? I say Catholic because we are in Texas, and there are weddings that take place with only sweet tea at the reception. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a really good Catholic wedding where multiple generations assemble. And if it's one of those weddings that, you know, you feel really good about, you love the bride, you love the groom, they have a solid faith, you're just so excited about this marriage. And, you know, multiple generations from both sides assemble. And when it's time to raise a glass to them, now, I assume I'm the only married guy in the room. I will share with you, I've been married for 25 years. When my wife and I go to a wedding, and it's often because we have a lot of non-Catholic students, it's often a non-Catholic ceremony. So it's a different ceremony than what my wife and I had. But it doesn't matter. When we go to a wedding and the vows are exchanged, we remember our wedding. You know, there's just something about the trigger of it. And then when we remember our wedding, we remember the people who are at our wedding. And so my parents aren't with me anymore. I remember how happy my parents were when I got married. They probably were a little skeptical it could happen. So they were, you know, there was such joy. And then when I remember them at my wedding, it makes me so happy, right? A wedding evokes such memories. Even at our wedding, Alexander and I, we just kept thinking about like what brought us together. Well, it was our parents' love. If our parents didn't love us, we wouldn't be here. If their parents didn't love them, you remember a chain of lovers. A marriage isn't just two monads coming together. It's bringing together this whole network of love. And you remember that. So when you raise a glass at a wedding to the new bride and the new groom, you're not just toasting two monads that have become an atom. You're toasting to a whole network of love. That's drinking to remember, right? That's good drinking. Now contrast that with a middle-aged guy at the end of the bar, just taking shot after shot, right? He's had a rough week. He's got a rough marriage. He's got a dead-end job. He's drinking to forget. That is unhealthy drinking. When you drink, drink to remember and not to forget. The fourth way to drink like a saint is to drink with a sense of merriment. I make a distinction between merriment and fun. There is absolutely nothing wrong with fun. Fun is fun. The distinction I would make, though, is fun is a pleasure that you can have alone. You know, you might have more fun playing video games with your buddies, but it is conceivable that you can still have fun playing a video game by yourself. Right? And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Merriment, on the other hand, presupposes fellowship. Merriment necessitates community. That is why we have the phrase, the more the merrier. And to my mind, there is something almost sacred about authentic merriment. It's not just collective fun. I don't know if it ties into memory or to honor. I'll give you an example. The phrase, Merry Christmas. Now, I know that it's come under fire because Christ's Mass is being mentioned. But don't let them know this. But the enemies of Merry Christmas don't know the half of it. Because isn't it the case that when you wish someone Merry Christmas, you're saying more than have a fun Christmas? Aren't you almost invoking a blessing on someone when you say Merry Christmas? Right? It's more than just have a fun Christmas. And think of how silly it would be to apply that word Merry to like a purely secular holiday. Merry Administrative Professionals Day. Kind of falls flat, doesn't it? But Merry Christmas, right? And the best gatherings are where people make merry, right? They're not just having fun, they're making merry. There's a genuine sense of merriment in the air. Again, a good Catholic wedding comes to mind. Also a good Irish wake, to be perfectly honest with you, is a certain kind of merriment and not just fun. Finally, to drink like a saint, drink with a sense of ritual. So the temptation that we modern Americans have is to think of joy or merriment and ritual as two mutually exclusive categories. We tend to think of ritual, if you'll forgive me, as a buzzkill, because it's, you know, it sort of hampers our spontaneity. But we Catholics know better. We Catholics know that ritual does not kill our joy. It channels it. It focuses it. It concentrates it. It energizes it, right? Ritual is like the image that Chesterton gives for orthodoxy. It's like the walls of a playground that in establishing a framework allow the children to play more fully than if those walls weren't there. Think of the importance, for example, of social rituals in our lives. They're not straitjackets. They're rules of engagement that allow us to get to know each other. Seriously, imagine if there were no social rituals about meeting someone for the first time. You know, we all know we're supposed to look each other in the eye, shake hands, establish eye contact, etc. Oh, our name, tell each other our names. But what if we just didn't know that? Think of how awkward things would be. We'd never get anywhere, right? You and I are separated, I think, by a generation or two. I'm Gen X. What do you got? I've lost track of the alphabet now. What? Gen Z?
Yeah, the worst ones. Sorry.
And what? You're the worst ones. Sorry. We're at the end of the alphabet. Isn't that good? So obviously there are some differences, but the one thing you and I have in common is that we both grew up in the wake of the sexual revolution, which means we both grew up in a culture of scorched earth. And so, for example, when it comes to courtship, when it comes to dating, it's infinitely more complicated for us than it was, say, in the 1950s. Why? Because the 1950s had a playbook. There was a shared set of social rituals that governed the interaction between the sexes, and that allowed, interestingly enough, that allowed for the sexes to practice both romance and honor at the same time. I'm interested in you, but I'm not a cad or a pervert. So I will follow these rules to express my interest. And then if you're interested, you can express your interest and still maintain your honor. Romance and honor are not mutually exclusive categories. Proper courtship was the way to integrate those two. But in the 60s, that was all seen as coercive, right? And so in the name of sexual liberation, we threw out the playbook. And the question is, how's that working out for us? Rather than feel liberated, don't we feel paralyzed? I see this with my students at Baylor all the time. They don't know how to date because there's no shared definition of dating. And so it's just weird. Maybe you're experiencing this. We're friends, and then suddenly we're engaged. How the hell did that happen? You know? And then there's the DTR. We need to define the relationship. Honey, if you need to define the relationship, what have you been in all this time? You know? Anyway, my point is this is all a breakdown of social ritual. Ritual is good. So to return to the subject of drinking, I'm not saying you need to have a solemn high liturgy every time you want to have a beer. There is one ritual associated with drinking that we all know about, a toast. Toasting is as old as drinking itself. The ancient Greeks would pour a libation, a portion out to honor the gods. One of the theories about clinking glasses is that it is a Christian innovation meant to imitate the peal of church bells driving demons away. Whatever the reason, it also makes sense because it's the fifth sense, especially with wine. So when you're toasting with wine, it's all five senses. It's the sight, it's the sound, the clink, right? It's the smell, it's the taste. And even notice the gesture of a toast. It's an act of supplication. It's an act of gratitude. It's an act of offering. Cheers. And a toast has the quality of a prayer. And sometimes I get asked, well, how do you make a toast? And I say, I'm really not being impious. I'm being most profoundly grateful. Imitate the structure of the collect of the Mass. The Roman orations have an ingenious structure. It's always, O God, who does X, Y, and Z, give us A, B, and C so we can get D, E, and F. Right? It's that same structure almost all the time. So you can do that for any occasion. You know, here's to John, who's with us tonight and got a promotion. you know, through the intercession of his patron saint, may he not screw up his new job, right? That's all it takes, right? And the great thing about a toast is just that one little ritual event turns an amorphous get-together into a real event. We have a reason to celebrate. We have a memory to cherish. We have something to honor. And that ennobles the gathering rather than, hey, let's just get together for drinks and talk about our feelings. You know, like, this is better. You can still talk about your feelings, but to have that kind of focus ennobles the event. So use a toast when you drink. I'll conclude with a great line from Joseph Pieper in his marvelous book, A Theory of Festivity. Pieper is actually quoting Nietzsche of all people when he says, the trick is not to arrange a festival, but to find people who can enjoy it. It seems to me that in this 21st century of ours, the question is not whether Catholics or Christians should drink, but whether we will be the only ones left capable of doing so. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.